And what a fascinating discussion tonight with Michio Kaku, Physics of the Future. Let's take the final hour here and take your phone calls with him on Coast to Coast AM. Michio, where do you see entertainment in 2100? I mean, now we're seeing it change dramatically, where, you know, the old DVD days are changing. Now they're downloading via satellite. They're feeding it to us. It's amazing. Where do you see it in 100 years from now?
Well, first of all, even before then, we'll be living in a world like The Matrix. Today, kids, of course, play video games as virtual reality. However, in the future, we'll have augmented reality in our contact lens. We'll be able to recreate entire scenes. And this means that gaming is going to change completely, that we're going to live in a holodeck. We're going to live in The Matrix, and not by 2100, but much earlier. The military has already have a prototype of this. I went down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where we actually filmed the military's matrix. It's four screens that make 360 degrees, so all the walls surrounding you are projectors. They can project in an object, an image of Baghdad, for example, in three dimensions. And you walk on a treadmill that is omnidirectional. That is, you can walk in any direction forever and never reach the end. And as you walk, all the images in three dimensions change. And I even ducked. I even went all the way to the ground, and all the images followed me as I ducked to the floor. So there are sensors in the helmet that determine exactly the position of my eyes. So as I moved my head, as I roamed around, as I walked, as I ran, all the images changed as if I was in Baghdad. And this is the military. This already exists. It's called the omnidirectional treadmill with the cave. The cave is the name for the 360-degree screens, and this is how we will function in the future. And, you know, with your contact lenses, you'll be able to see images of all your loved ones at Christmas time, even if they can't visit you. You'll simply have Christmas with virtual family members sitting around the table, all appearing in your contact lens, as if they were real.
Will people be escaping into this virtual reality world, you know, and would they be able to, will they say, well, I want to go to the virtual reality nightclub, and all of a sudden you're in it. Or I want to be able to go to this baseball game, and all of a sudden you're sitting in this virtual stadium. Will they do that?
It's possible. You know, with animals, we've located their pleasure center, and you can stimulate that with a telegraph key. And so when mice can stimulate their own pleasure center, they stimulate it until they starve to death. They die, because they hit that key several times a second with their paw until they die. Well, scientists have gone up the evolutionary scale. And by the time you hit the porpoise can hit the pleasure center with its beak back and forth, and it will also do it, but then it realizes that it will die. It's starving to death. So it stops, go out, grab some fish, and then goes back to hitting that little tile again. Now, they've actually done this with prisoners in jails. I'm not sure how ethical that is. People have volunteered to have their pleasure center stimulated. So there is a chance. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a chance that a certain fraction of the human race may decide to live in a virtual world and stimulate their pleasure center and not interact with reality. That is a danger. That's a danger that we have to be very careful about. The virtual reality and the matrix may become so realistic that some people may want to say, hey, let's spend the rest of our lives there.
All right, let's go to the phones. Christine is in St. Louis, east of the Rockies. Hey, Christine, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning.
Hi. Morning.
Good morning. I'd like to know, are there cures for cancer, MS, autism, asthma, things like that?
Okay, well, you've asked a very embarrassing question, because science today has not even isolated the genes that are responsible for very common illnesses like schizophrenia, autism, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. We've cured many of the diseases that are created by microbes. We're very good at zapping microbes. But when it comes to autoimmune diseases like arthritis, when it comes to genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis and Tay-Sachs disease and multigenic diseases like schizophrenia, it's a lot harder. So, but cancer, on the other hand, we're making pretty big inroads. As I mentioned earlier, we have smart bombs that can target cancer. They're not yet commercially available. We have a lot of years of hard work before it becomes FDA approved, but they zero in on cancer cells without having to use chemotherapy. We're not there yet, but we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And as I mentioned, your toilet will have the power to detect proteins emitted from cancer colonies of 100 or so cancer cells 10 years before a tumor forms. So the word tumor could disappear from the English language.
That's fascinating. Let's go to Brennan, Louisville, Kentucky. There you go, Brennan. Welcome to the show.
Good evening. I wanted to ask, on the 26th of February, 2009, my friend had passed away. He actually had an ultralight plane crash, and he died hours later on the next day. And I have a concept that I would, as you were talking earlier, about sending atoms back in time, not trying to time travel myself, but to be able to take and send a message potentially to my friend's cell phone. And simply say, stay off the ultralight, and then I wanted to understand. Number one, is that possible? Number two, what would be the technology? I had an opportunity to talk to Dr. David Lewis Anderson, and he said that yes, the technology exists, but no, the average civilian will not likely have access to that. And so I wanted to know, what is the technology? Will it be affected by string theory? And if so, or if not, what can I do to bring about saving my friend from the tragic accident that happened about 2 years ago?
Wow.
Well, many physicists do believe that some forms of time travel may be possible. Like even Stephen Hawking has written about it. I've written about it. Many physicists have looked at it. But there are huge problems. One is the energy, the energy necessary to bend time into a pretzel. You're talking about the energy of a black hole. Now, you talk about sending atoms into the past. That's also been looked at. Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate, won the Nobel Prize, in fact, for solving a sticky problem in the quantum theory. The quantum theory actually does allow for sending atoms back into the past. So Richard Feynman, the future Nobel laureate, was puzzled by that, and he figured out the riddle. It turns out that when matter is sent back into the past, it's antimatter. Now, antimatter has the opposite charge. But Feynman said that it's ordinary matter. It looks like it has opposite charge, but it's simply going backwards in time. Therefore, antimatter is nothing but ordinary matter, garden variety matter going backwards in time. Now, this also laid to rest the idea of sending a message or Morse code into the past.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be great to have a telephone conversation with the past so you can tell your relatives, watch out, don't do this, don't do that, you know, go to college, get a good job, don't become like a drug addict. Wouldn't it be great to talk to people in the past? It turns out that antimatter is causal. That is, it obeys the laws of causality, cause and effect. So even though matter can go backwards in time in the form of antimatter, it's useless in terms of sending a message backwards in time. Because ordinary antimatter looks like matter, except it has the opposite charge. Well, Feynman went on to win the Nobel Prize. He won the Nobel Prize in 1965 for this kernel of an idea that became what is known as quantum electrodynamics. So, yeah, it may be possible to go backwards in time, but no messages. Sorry about that.
Can you go backward in time and see yourself?
Well, people have looked at that. If you have a wormhole, that is, you can bend the fabric of space and time, which is, of course, allowed by many theories, it means that you could visit yourself as a child. If you saw the latest Star Trek movie, Spock goes back in time and sees himself as a young man.
Right. Yeah.
And then what happens if you see yourself as a young man? Well, what happens is the river of time forks into two rivers. And the latest Star Trek movie actually has the best description of this. If the river of time forks into two rivers, there's an alternate you in another time stream. Maybe you can visit it. It looks like the young version of you, but it's not really you. You had your own memories. You had your own past. You're looking at a carbon copy of yourself, basically.
Okay, back to the phones. We'll go to Tim in Phoenix, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Tim, good morning. You're on.
Hi, good morning, George. I wanted to ask Dr. Kaku. Actually, I had a quick question about antimatter since you brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I can hear you fine.
Okay, Dr. Kaku, if there's an antimatter equivalent of me going backwards in time right now, when I die, am I born? and... If you follow my meaning.
Right.
Another question I had is the physicists are constantly trying to balance the four, you know, trying to find a unified filter to balance the four forces. Carl Jung was obsessed with something he called the quadrality, I think it was. And that was, you know, it was like air, earth, water, and fire. And he was a believer in astrology. You know, if you ever follow astrology, you know that the four forces, air, earth, water, and fire, coincide with, the elements, the old Greek elemental theory. Have you ever studied that in trying to figure out the connection to the four forces?
Well, let's break it down one at a time. We saw the movie Benjamin Button, right, with Brad Pitt,
yes,
where he gets younger and younger, and when everyone else gets older and older. That's actually how the universe looks like if you're made out of antimatter. If you're made out of antimatter, which is ordinary matter, garden variety matter going backwards in time, then as time goes by, you do get younger. You do get younger. However, as I pointed out, it turns out that antimatter is causal. It obeys the laws of cause and effect, okay? So if A happens, then B happens later, afterwards, not before. And so that sort of laid to rest the idea that you could send atoms going back into the past. But it wasn't until Feynman figured it out in the 1940s and 50s. Feynman, by the way, was also one of the inventors of the atomic bomb. When Feynman figured it out, he realized that there is a purpose for antimatter, that antimatter is nothing but ordinary matter going backwards in time. Now, the other thing you raised is about the elements. The Greeks did have these four elements, but they also believed that there was a particle of these elements, and they were called atoms. Now, A means cannot, tom means cut. So atom means cannot cut. So the Greeks believe that, yeah, there are four elements, but each of the four elements is based on a fundamental layer called the atom, things that cannot be cut. Now we can split atoms, right? And inside atoms we find nucleuses of protons and neutrons. Now we split them apart and we find quarks and thousands of subatomic particles. And now we believe that those subatomic particles are nothing but musical notes on a vibrating string. So that all the particles that we find with our atom smashes are nothing but musical notes on a vibrating rubber band. So physics is the laws of harmony of the string. Chemistry are the melodies you can play by interacting strings. The universe is a symphony of strings. And the mind of God that Einstein would eloquently write about, is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. That is our best candidate for the mind of God.
What's your take on wormholes? What's on the other side, Michio?
Well, we don't know, but if we have a multiverse of universes that is a bubble bath, with each bubble popping and bumping into other bubbles, when two bubbles collide, that could be the Big Bang. The Big Bang could have been the collision of two bubbles. And then you wonder, well, what's on the other side of forever? What lies in these other universes? Well, that's a source of enormous debate right now. We do think that there could be different laws of physics. That, you know, they always say that magic and witchcraft is not possible because it violates the laws of physics, right? Well, why not change the laws of physics? The laws of physics may change in these other bubbles. This is something that is freaky, but is definitely allowed in string theory, that we could have different laws in other universes. Now, can we make contact with them? It's very difficult to make contact with them. But, for example, there's a many-worlds theory that says that these other universes exist in your living room, but they vibrate at a different frequency. Therefore, we can no longer contact them, just like we cannot contact Radio Moscow or BBC Radio, even though it's in your room. In your room, there's the waves of BBC Radio. In your room, there's the radio of Radio Cuba, Radio Havana. But we cannot interact with them because they vibrate at a different frequency. So this means, and many Nobel laureates have written about this, like Steven Weinberg, this means that in your room, in your living room, there could be the waves of dinosaurs. There could be the waves of Elvis Presley, people that have long died in other universes are still alive, and they're right with you. They're in your room, but they're vibrating at a different frequency. We've decohered from them. That's a scientific word. We've decohered from these other universes, so we cannot make contact with loved ones who are still alive in other universes but have died in our universe.
And the future could be there, too.
Maybe the future. This is called the many-worlds theory. It was once poo-pooed and laughed at when it was first proposed in the 1950s. But with the coming of string theory, it's being resurrected. People are really seriously looking at it now, and we now realize that it could be the fundamental basis of quantum theory, which is what I do for a living. The quantum theory, which makes possible transistors, lasers, the internet, iPods, and iPads, all the wonders of the modern age are byproducts of the quantum theory. And the quantum theory is based on many worlds. So, yeah, it could be true.
I've always thought the wormholes, too, Michio, might be portals to other universes.
Yes, that's exactly what they are. We don't know how difficult it is to go through. First of all, we do believe they exist. But whether or not you can safely make it through to the other side is a matter of intense debate. Stephen Hawking's last book, in fact, had a whole book talking about whether or not you can safely make it to the other side. Under certain circumstances, we think, yeah, you can probably make it to the other side. It's still controversial. There's no universal consensus. Ultimately, string theory will make the decision. Ultimately, the equations will dictate whether or not we can go to the other side.
And they are or they are not. We'll
That's
find
right.
out.
It's a decidable question. It's not science fiction. It's not mysticism. It's a decidable question.
Austin, Texas. Hi, Laura. Go ahead. You're up with us.
Hi.
Hi.
Is it me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. My phone faded out. George, I wanted to make a comment and ask one question.
Sure.
I wanted to thank you both for this program. I really need it. I've been so depressed and saddened by the disaster and suffering in Japan. And I want to thank you, George, for your calmness, and you, Dr. Kaku, for just your spirit. You're positive and optimistic, and you sound happy, and it's very life-expanding and affirming, and so thank you. Especially, you know, last night was a downer with Ed Dames talking about most people dying from a solar event, and so it's good to get this positive feeling, you know, and perspective. My question is, I've heard a lot of controversy about microwave ovens, and I wanted to ask Dr. Kaku what he thinks about the accusations that they alter or deform the cellular structure of food, and ask him if he thinks they're safe.
All right. You want to take a jump at that, Mitchell?
Okay, sure. First of all, microwave radiations do not rip apart atoms like X-rays. X-rays are definitely dangerous. That's what we find in Japan right now. All those high readings on Geiger counters are subatomic particles and X-rays. They're definitely dangerous because they rip apart atoms. Microwaves are low energy. On one hand, they do not rip apart atoms. They are not ionizing, as we say, like X-rays. So that's out of the picture, the whole question of breaking of atoms. But then the question is, do they break up cells? Okay. Well, what microwaves do is they heat up the water molecule. That's why you can put plastic in a microwave oven and nothing happens, right? But you put water inside a microwave oven and water heats up. Now, water is part of food. Most of food is water.
That's right.
And says microwaves resonate the atom, the molecule of water. That's why food heats up from the inside out rather than the outside in. That's why you do not get that golden crust, the crisp golden crust. You don't get that with microwaves because microwaves penetrate the potato, let's say, heat the inside, and it uniformly heats the microwaves. So as far as food is concerned, yes, there's destruction of food, but you see, you're a safe distance away. There's a grid, that you can see through the grid. That is called a Faraday box. A Faraday box was invented 150 years ago by Michael Faraday himself.
Hold on, Michael. Hold on, Michio. We'll talk about that Michael Faraday box in just a moment. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to be talking about some scary stories for a while, followed by open lines as we lead into the extreme supermoon, which will hit on Saturday, and that could mean earthquakes. We'll talk about that, too, on Coast to Coast AM. Let's come right back with final calls with Michio Kaku in his book, Physics of the Future, on Coast to Coast AM. Michio, we were talking about the microwave ovens before the break got us. I'll let you finish that up, then a few more questions for you.
Okay, how dangerous is a microwave oven? Well, inside the microwave oven, of course, it's quite dangerous because the water molecule is excited by microwaves. However, you look inside and there's a grid. There's a grid. Now, some of that microwaves do leak out. This is called a Faraday box, a Faraday cage. Michael Faraday used to put himself in a metal cage and hit enormous electric fields, almost like lightning bolts, and he wasn't fazed at all. So like if a lightning bolt hits your car, for example, don't touch the car, but the car itself will act like a Faraday cage, and inside you're not going to be affected so much. So So that's the metal grid. However, there's holes in that grid, which means there's leakage that takes place. So I would not spend too much time staring into the microwave oven looking at how your food is being done, because microwaves will leak out even outside of a Faraday cage. But the damage is done basically inside the Faraday cage, not outside. But the Faraday cage is not totally perfect.
Okay, let's go back to final calls now. Annie in Portland, Oregon, first-time caller. Hi, Annie. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
It's an honor to talk to you both.
Mm-hmm.
This is amazing. And I have one of your books, Physics of the Impossible.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what the theory is, if there was a spaceship that could go 20 light years away, if there's another galaxy,
mm-hmm.
how affected it would be by radiation.
Oh, you mean radiation in a starship going across planets and galaxies?
Like going through the Van Allen belt.
Yeah, well, that is a problem. You know, in fact, some people even think that we never went to the moon because the Van Allen belt is so radioactive around the Earth. Well, you know, the astronauts had to be timed, and they had to be shot at the right angle so they would not get maximum radiation going to the moon. And it's true, in outer space, it's radioactive. You know, taking a transatlantic flight, just going to Los Angeles or New York, you get about a millirem per hour of radiation. That's a chest X-ray by the time you land. So they don't tell you this, but it's like getting a chest X-ray every time you go transatlantic. And that means that the personnel, the stewardesses, the pilots, they will suffer some premature aging as a consequence of the fact that there are cosmic rays up there. And the astronauts have to worry about this. The astronauts suffer a lot more radiation in outer space, and that's going to affect the Mars program. We're going to have to shield the astronauts from radiation. For example, on the moon, they have to worry about solar flares. We're thinking about if they ever go to the moon or Mars, they should find a cave, a ready-made space station in a cave, safely protected by tons and tons of dirt. Okay, so this is a real problem that astronauts are going to face once we go into deep space where there are solar flares, there are cosmic rays, and we're going to have shielding for them, which is very expensive. But that's the price we're going to have to pay if we want to go to the stars. We're going to have to shield our astronauts from radiation. Now, our atmosphere shields us, but in outer space, there's no air, of course, and therefore we're going to have to bring our own shielding with us.
Let's go to Riverdale, New York. Mad Dog is with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How are you?
Good.
Dr. Kaku, how are you?
Very good.
I wanted to ask you a question now. What is the most retrievable source of DNA from a dead person's body, and is it possible to produce a perfect clone from this DNA?
Well, so far, we have never cloned a primate successfully, let alone a human. So don't believe it when some people claim that they've cloned a full human being.
And they do say that.
They do say that, yeah. But, you know, we have not even done it successfully for a primate, let alone a human being, right? Now, any cell of the body, in principle, can be taken. Which means that in the future, like tabloid newspapers, they'll go to barbershops. They'll go everywhere to find the DNA of celebrities, have the gene sequenced to find out what lurks in the genome of some famous movie star, right? Or matchmakers. Matchmakers used to ask questions about the genealogy of prospective husbands and prospective wives. Now all they have to do is get some dandruff or hair follicles or a licking of a postage stamp in order to get DNA.
Right. That's right.
So your body is constantly shedding thousands and thousands of cells, each of which can be used to sequence a human body. In fact, some police, when they have a suspect who does not want to have his DNA analyzed, sometimes they ask them to lick a postage stamp.
They trick him, right?
They trick him. And when they lick the postage stamps, oops, there goes your DNA. So, you're constantly shedding DNA. And that's going to be a problem for movie stars of the future, even political candidates. You know that Herbert Humphrey, who ran against, I think it was Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon, back in 1968.
Yeah, some of his DNA is still preserved. It was preserved in urine. We've analyzed it, and bingo, there's the gene, the P53 mutated gene for cancer. And that's what killed Hubert Humphrey. So in other words, if you know the DNA of presidential candidates, you may not want to vote for that presidential candidate, knowing that he may die in office. Kennedy, for example, had deformed adrenal glands. Of course, they didn't know it when he ran against Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon ran against Hubert Humphrey, and he had damaged P53 gene, which linked to cancer. So in the future, even political candidates may have their DNA analyzed.
Yeah, Kennedy healed his, he hid his illnesses, didn't he?
That's right. He hid his illnesses. And in the future, tabloids will get postage stamps and hair follicles from political candidates, sequence them, and find out exactly what lurks in your genome. I had my genomes read, not all my genes, by BBC Television. And I, you know, they took some of my blood, sent it to Vanderbilt University, and I had a CD-ROM coming back with most of my genes on it. Not all, of course. It's still quite expensive. It costs about $10,000 to sequence all your genes today. But in my book, I say that in the coming years, it'll go down to $1,000, and then beyond that, $100. And then after that, your credit card. You could have all your genes placed on something as small as your credit card in the future.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Bob in Albany, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hi, I met you, and George, nice to speak with you.
Sure thing.
Mm-hmm. I have a question, and then I have some very good news about the future. The question is the scientific community putting together a DNA bank similar to the seed bank that Norway has so that in the future, even if it's 100 or 200 years away, when the technology and the science catches up, we can reclone some of the species that may be lost? And go ahead.
Yeah, this is the so-called doomsday gene bank. We want to make sure that in case of a catastrophe and civilization falls apart, that we have seeds, DNA, whatever, necessary to regenerate an entire civilization after an ice age, meteor impact, nuclear war, or some kind of catastrophe. So, yeah, there are people who are creating these seed banks and DNA banks, hoping that we will survive even the worst possible catastrophe.
Oh, well, that's good to know. The good news about the future is relates to all of the guests that you have had, George, that have been talking about the future. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen is a higher consciousness, an elevated consciousness of all of the people. And this will come about because of the connection between the conscious portion of our mind and the energy part of our mind. In fact, this has already happened, and hopefully one of these days I'll get to do a show with you, George, about this, because it's very exciting, because the energy side of our nature can pump up or amp up the conscious portion of our mind tremendously.
All right. Well said. I'm very interested in that, indeed. Michio, your book, is it out now?
Yes, it just came out yesterday. I did a book signing in New York. I signed 90 books. And if you go to my website, mkaku.org, M-K-A-K-U, mkaku.org, it lists all the cities I'll be in, a 10-city book tour. So maybe I'll be signing your listeners' books as I travel around the country.
I'm sure you will.
Hey, it's being excerpted in Newsweek magazine, the New York Post. It got great reviews.
You're getting great reviews.
The Economist had a glowing review of the book. So, yeah, it's hot off the press. Just came out the other day.
You could tell you had fun doing this.
It was so much fun. You know, ever since I was a kid, I've been like a kid in a candy store, because I've always wondered about the scientific future. I mean, what kinds of things are scientists cooking up? Now I can just get on the telephone, call people, and ask them, what are you working on? And they are anxious to get their word out. You see, they don't have access to the media, right? They just toil away, you know, some kind of scientist in a basement, whatever, and hoping to get a therapy, an invention that's going to change the universe. But that's all they do. So I talk to them. I bring a TV crew, film them, put them on BBC, put them on the Discovery Channel, and spread the good news.
Are you a believer in intelligent design?
Well, put it this way. When we talk about the Big Bang, when we talk about where the laws of physics came from, not just the laws of evolution, but when you talk about where the laws of physics came from, even Einstein had a hard time grappling with that question. He was asked that question, is there a God? Is there an intelligent designer? And here's how he answered it. He said there are two kinds of gods. We have to be clear about what we mean. He said first is the God, the personal God that answers prayers, the God of Moses and Jacob, the God that does magical tricks, answers your prayers. He had a hard time believing in that God. However, he believed in the God of Spinoza, the God of design, the God that said that the universe is gorgeous, beautiful, elegant, simple, and it didn't have to be that way. The laws of physics have been chaotic. The laws of physics could have been ugly. But there they are, beautiful, gorgeous, a handful of equations that govern stars and galaxies. It's amazing. So Einstein believed in the God of harmony, the God of order, simplicity, and elegance.
Okay, next up we go to Mike in Brooklyn, New York. Mike, thank you for holding. Go ahead.
Hi, Dexter. Dexter Montreal.
That's my future name.
Well, good. My question is this, gentlemen. If everybody came into the universe, say the size of the planet Earth, wouldn't it have an effect, gravitational effect, on, let's say, Pluto and other bodies or the planet moons? And what about Mercury? Shouldn't Mercury be wobbling all over the place? Why I'm asking this is because this so-called mysterious planet on the other side of the sun. And I'm wondering what you gentlemen think about that.
You've heard of a couple astronomers, Michio, that believe that there is a massive size object in the solar system that hasn't officially been discovered yet. And some believe that it could be the so-called Planet X.
Well, you know, we scientists have the Kepler satellite orbiting in outer space that has discovered 1,200 possible planets. Some of them are actually rather bizarre looking. Some of them have two planets on opposite sides of their star. So it's sort of like a dumbbell where the two bells rotate around each other. One planet is on the opposite side of the mother star. And we find not just one, but actually a few planets in this weird situation. So we do know that such a situation is stable. You can have a solar system based on this kind of counter-Earth idea. But our Earth is probably alone in the sense that we have Newton's laws of gravity, which allows us to send space probes right through the rings of Saturn. That's how accurate Newton's laws of gravity are. And if there was a counter-Earth on the other side of Earth, Earth 2, as they call it in the comic books, Earth 2, we would detect its gravitational presence, and it would perturb the orbit of the Earth, perturb the orbit of Venus and Mars, and we see no perturbation. So we're pretty confident that there's no planet on the other side of the sun, even though it's mathematically feasible. In fact, we see these things now with the Kepler satellite. I should also point out that the Kepler satellite has shown that one out of every 200 stars has a habitable Earth. Now, this is huge.
That is huge.
This result only came out last month. For the first time in world history, we can put a number on this. One in 200 stars, on average, has an Earth-like habitable planet in the Goldilocks zone where there's liquid water, perhaps.
That could make for billions of Earth-like planets.
That's right. In our own galaxy, half a billion Earth-like planets in the Goldilocks zone, not too close, not too far from the sun. This is huge. Before, we could only speculate. You know, everyone had an idea about how many planets are in the galaxy. Now we can give you a number backed up by our latest satellite, the Kepler, now in orbit. I mean, this is huge. There's half a billion Earth-like planets in our galaxy, we think.
If you had that magic wand, Michio, and you were allowed to wave it and get one thing done of anything you've always wanted done with the regards to science and physics, what would that be?
Well, I work in string theory, where every day we twist the forces of the universe, we twist time into a pretzel, we even have multiple times, not just one clock, but several clocks going on simultaneously in a hyperdimensional universe. This is my world. This is the world that I live in. But it'd be great if we could actually build a machine that could harness some of these things. If you're a Type 3 civilization, you actually have the energy to access this power. It's called the Planck energy. And the Planck energy is 10 to the 19 billion electron volts. That's one with 19 zeros after it. That's a quadrillion times more powerful than the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland. But wouldn't it be great if you could somehow hitchhike on a Type 3 civilization starship and see their machines that are able to access the Planck energy, to twist time into a pretzel, to punch a hole in space? That would be fantastic. That would really make my day.
Ricky's in San Diego. Go ahead, Ricky. We'll squeeze you in here.
Yeah, hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I have a two-part question for Mr.
Let's go with the one part because the clock will get us. Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, the one part is that I have this question, this thing is driving me crazy, and I can't figure it out, I'm glad I can ask, get a chance to ask Mr. Kaku about this, because this is something that I think everybody on the planet wants to know.
All right,
I am going to ask you this question. What came first, the chicken or the egg?
Ah.
Well, the answer is they both probably came out at the same time. If you take a look at evolution, you go back to more and more primitive organisms until you finally go back to single-celled organisms which simply split apart. So there's this continuum, a continuum between cells that split apart. And at some point in juncture, cells that split apart, one cell then became a part of an egg. And so the chicken or egg thing, both were essentially were created out of the same protoplasm out of which life came. So the answer to the question is they were both created simultaneously at the same time.
That'll have you scratch your head, though, Michio, won't it?
Yeah, it does. It does make you think about it. You have to go back to evolution to see exactly at what point mitosis turned into sexual differentiation. It's tough because there are gaps. There are gaps in the evolutionary tree. So you have to, use your imagination to fill in that gap. But basically, the answer is they were both formed at the same time.
Will your book signing bring you to Los Angeles?
Yes, definitely. I'll be speaking at Caltech. So I'll be in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Boston. I'll be hitting all the big cities, Chicago, Minneapolis. It's all on my website, mkaku, mkaku.org.
Super. Michio, thank you so much. Michio Kaku, Physics of the Future, always a wonderful guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Tim Banal, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.